Please be seated.
The second case for our argument this morning is LeBolt Farmers Grain Company Appellant versus Western Consolidated Cooperative Appellee. The court would like to welcome students from Soy Buttes High School, Western Dakota Tech, and Bonham High School. Once again, a reminder, if you wish to, there are publications out in the hallway explaining how our legal system works, and another on the pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. Please feel free to help yourselves. The appellant in this case is represented by Mr. Greg Peterson, an attorney from Aberdeen. And the appellees are represented by Mr. Richard Russman and Ms. Kimberly Dorsett, attorneys from Aberdeen. Ms. Dorsett, you're going first, correct, for 10 minutes?
Yes.
And then Mr. Russman, you'd be the presenter for the second 10 minutes?
Yes.
All right. Very well. Then, Mr. Peterson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. I am Greg Peterson, representing LeBolt Farmers Grain. I believe this case today, this particular appeal, brings to this court an opportunity to clarify the law that has been adopted by our legislature, the Uniform Contribution Among Tortfeasors Act, and to give some guidance on whether it applies to protect only defendants in contribution claims or whether it also protects defendants against a plaintiff by limiting the defendant's liability to not more than twice the defendant's percentage of responsibility. Second issue that I'd like to discuss during this morning's argument has to do with the application of the rule of mitigation of damages in a conversion action, a case or a rule rather that this court has spoken to on two prior occasions, but under the circumstances presented here, I'd like the court to take that opportunity once again to further clarify how that rule is applied. The core facts of this case are these. Westcon Cooperative purchased the Harvest States elevator in Milbank, South Dakota in 2003. At that time, Lynn Pugh had been employed by Harvest States as an independent trucker hauling grain back and forth between the Harvest States elevator and Milbank and some outlying areas. After he lost that job when Westcon took over, he helped himself to some grain on more than 100 occasions. As a consequence, he was ultimately discovered approximately 25 months later, caught in the act, was arrested under federal charges, pled guilty, and was convicted and is doing time in a federal correctional facility. As I mentioned, during that time, he stole approximately 130 loads of grain. My client, LeBolt, bought approximately 78 of those loads of grain. An ethanol facility near Milbank bought between 8 and 10 loads, and another elevator in Wheaton, Minnesota, bought the balance somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 loads. Wheaton and Northern Lights ethanol facility are not parties to this action.
Tell me something about, I'm not real familiar with grain purchases and things of that nature. Is there some practice in this industry where a grain company, before they buy something, checks to make sure that the grain is coming from a legitimate source, that they have a bill of sale for the grain, things like that, or is it just simply traded like cash? To whoever shows up with a load of grain, they buy it and that's it.
When a new patron, and I can only speak to the evidence that we have in this case because we don't have any expert testimonial evidence or standard in the industry evidence. When a new patron would show up at our cooperative, that patron would have to give certain identifying information. And because of the risk of buying mortgage grain, there are several procedures employed to check the Secretary of State's website for any financing statements. There's a practice, at least at the LeBolt elevator, where they've got a close enough relationship with the area banks that if there's a troubled debtor, one of the banks will most often notify the elevator, and there's some other safety mechanisms employed. Having become a patron, then the farmer continues to bring grain to the elevator, brings his truck across the scale, is given I want to call it a delivery ticket, but I don't think I have the right nomenclature, and that delivery ticket is either converted into a check for cash, which is usually mailed subsequently, or else the farmer can store the grain, play the market.
You say farmer. Now, Mr. Pugh was not a farmer, was he? Or
he was not a farmer, but that was not known to LeBolt Farmers Grain because he represented himself as a farmer.
All right, thank you.
Shortly after the case was brought, just to bring us all current to the statement of the case, shortly after the case was brought only against Lynn Pugh, the trucker, the converter, several months later, Westcon moved and obtained an order from the court allowing for an amended complaint, which brought my client into the mix. And it also brought Lynn Pugh's wife into the mix, being the recipient of property purchased with the proceeds of stolen grain. After a period of discovery, Westcon moved for summary judgment, and it was granted. Judge Tim ruled that the rule of mitigation of damages would not be applicable in this case, but he did so without explanation. And he also ruled that the Uniform Contribution Among Tortfeasors Act had no application insofar as Westcon's, the plaintiff's claim against my client, LeBolt. In other words, we were not entitled to the benefit of that act, specifically 15-8-15.1, which limits a party's liability to not more than that party's percentage of negligence. Excuse me, not negligence, because the statute doesn't use negligence. It uses the word fault, and I think that's a critical distinction. To understand the application of the act, I think we have to go to the genesis of the act and the purpose of the act. We know that it was adopted in South Dakota in 1945 following a recommendation from the Uniform Laws Commission, which promulgated this most of what we have in our statutes in 1939. The common law at that time did not permit a plaintiff a recovery if the plaintiff was contributory negligent, even in a slight percentage. Therefore, there was no reason to apportion fault between plaintiffs and defendants. Secondly, plaintiffs were not able to commonly bring actions against more than one tortfeasor in a single action. From the defense side, the untoward result of the common law was the right of contribution was not acknowledged, so that a defendant could not sue a co-defendant. And the source of the information I'm giving you comes in part from a law review article, an ALR article that was cited in the case, this court's case of Brown versus Murdy. That citation is 34 ALR 2nd, 1107. And one note from that article states that the statute is designed to embody a common policy to abandon that common law rule denying the right of contribution among joint tortfeasors. I also have information, some of the information I'm giving the court comes from the Uniform Laws Annotated. Uniform Apportionment of Tort Responsibility Acts references and annotations, and more specifically, there's a comment from comments published from the committee appointed by and representing the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in preparing the Uniform Apportionment of Tort Responsibility Act. And Jean LeBrun from Rapid City is the chair of that committee, and these comments were published in 2008. In response to the unfairness that I mentioned, those first three things, that contributory negligence being an absolute defense and so forth, the uniform laws put forth what we adopted in Chapter 15-8. However, it's important to note that 15-8-15.1 and 15.2 were not part of the 1939 Act. Those two statutes were adopted by our legislature in 1987. I submit as a response to what was going on in the tort system at that time. In the 1960s and 1970s, most jurisdictions had abandoned contributory negligence as a complete bar, and they were proceeding to adopt some type of comparative fault system. And also in the court systems throughout the nation, the defendants were not meeting with much success in trying to file their claims for contribution. Consequently, I think our legislature adopted that section 15.1 and 15.2. And here's what some other courts around the country have said about those two sections. We don't have a great amount of pronouncement from this court on what those two sections mean. I will get to that in just a moment. But we have a case, for example, in South Carolina, which was not included in our brief, and I apologize for that. I just discovered it here in this past week.
Then you need to provide copies. Or 10 copies to the court?
Subsequently?
Yeah.
Very well. May I state the case name is
Fernandez? Sure, go ahead.
Fernandez versus Marks Construction, found at 499 Southeast 2nd 509. It's a 1998 case. Noting that 26 states have limited the doctrine, that, again, the doctrine was a pure joint and several liability doctrine that the legislature responded to in 1987. This South Carolina case noted that 26 states have limited the doctrine's application either to certain types of damages, to cause certain causes of action, or to cases involving certain percentages of contributory negligence, which is precisely what our legislature did in 1987. That court, that South Carolina court, paid note to the statute that had been adopted in South Dakota and noted that joint and several liability is not consistent with the purpose of comparative negligence, which is to apportion damages on the basis of relative fault. Instead of apportioning damages based on relative fault with a pure joint and several liability situation, we apportion damages based upon one tortfeasor's ability to pay. Our statute was also noted just almost parenthetically by a federal district court, 878 F sup 473, dealing with a multi-district litigation, asbestos litigation question. And that court simply noted that the explosion in tort litigation and subsequent statutory reforms has led to a current patchwork of statutes. As a matter of fact, this committee that I referenced earlier has noted that we really have no uniform law at all anymore. Many of the states who adopted the Uniform Act have since moved away from that completely, either abolishing it completely or significantly amending it to their own particular state statutes.
You know, Mr. Peterson, though, no matter what the substantive law on contribution, you know, it's always been my understanding that the issue doesn't even arise until one party pays more than its pro rata share. And I understand your argument, but aren't you really being premature? Because, I mean, Judge Tim at some point is going to have to make that determination. And I know that you want that determination made now, but your client hasn't actually, at the time Judge Tim made his decision, your client hadn't paid more than his pro rata share or its pro rata share.
That's true, Your Honor. But in response to that, let me suggest this sequence of how I believe the statute should be interpreted and applied. In the first instance, we have 15-8-13, which talks about a joint tortfeasor is not entitled to a money judgment for contribution until he has paid more than his share. So granted, you're not entitled to a money judgment. However, part of the Uniform Act, which is not codified at 15.8, is codified in our Rules of Civil Procedure, 15-6-14A. The very last couple of sentences there were also part of the 1939 Uniform Act. And those sentences specifically provide, number one, that a defendant can third party in another defendant who may be liable for the loss. And number two, specifically states, as among joint tortfeasors against whom a judgment has been entered in a single action, the provisions of Section 15, that's 15.8.15, apply only if the issue of proportionate fault is litigated between them by cross-claim, counterclaim, or third-party claim, which is what we attempted to do in this action.
But still, that begs the question, because the trial court doesn't have to try third-party claims and cross-claims at the same time that it tries the main claim.
No, but I believe this court has said that the trial courts may do that. The case that I want to bring to the court's attention is...
But even if they may, that doesn't mean Judge Tim was required to, does it?
Well, I don't know. I haven't researched that, Your Honor, to be able to respond specifically.
But isn't that the basis of your argument? That he must have done so? If I understand your argument, you're saying he should have, and that's why you're appealing.
The court should have, yes, because the court should have applied Section 15.1 to limit my client's exposure to the plaintiff's claim to not more than twice its percentage of fault. If we had done that, just walk with me through this. If we had done that, we made our cross claims against the other defendants, and if the court had litigated those issues, and if we had been assessed, just hypothetically speaking, 10% of the fault, the court would have entered a judgment for 20%, being twice our percentage of fault, since we would be less than a 50% tortfeasor. At that point in time, a judgment would be entered in favor of the plaintiff against my client for 20%. Then, if I pay my 20%, I go back to the court under my theory of contribution, ask the court for a judgment against my co-defendants for the 10% over and above my percentage of fault that I have paid for. That's how that is a limiting statute. It's not a limiting statute at the front end of my whole proceeding. It's at the back end before I can ever take judgment against my co-defendants, because the right of contribution is clearly acknowledged.
So how does that affect the total judgment that was secured by the plaintiff against your client?
Well, we know that in multiple cases where there's multiple defendants, we send special interrogatories to the jury and we ask them to apportion fault. And so as this court looked at in the Landstrom versus Shaver case, Shaver versus Landstrom case, there were several defendants in that case. Some defendants were singly liable, some were jointly and severally liable, and some were equally liable, according to this court's account of that case, of that verdict. And in that case, judgment was entered against each of those defendants, and we've got two tables published in that decision that show precisely how that judgment was entered, and therefore how the bond on appeal, which was the issue in that case, should then be apportioned. And I note that in that case, this court did not require the joint and several liability defendants to produce bonds for the whole, for the joint.
But isn't that a stretch? I mean, it was probably never even argued. It was a bond case.
Well, it was, but the court made several statements about joint and several liability that I thought gave us in the trial bar some instruction. This court said that 15-8-15.1 is directed to the collection of judgments. Now, would that be a blank statement that would apply only to judgments of defendants for contribution, or would it also be a statement of collection of judgments by plaintiffs against defendants? Secondly, this court talked about the amounts of bonds being a total amount for which each is proportionately liable. And it doesn't say to plaintiff, but it seems clear to me that it should be proportionately liable to the plaintiff, because that's what we were talking about in the whole body of the case. Interestingly, the plaintiff in Shaver did not even raise that as an issue, saying that you should force these people to each produce a bond for the whole amount of the judgment because they're each individually, jointly, and severally liable. Plaintiff appeared content to seek a bond for twice the percentage of fault apportioned to each. By the way, the court case that I was talking about, where this court seems to have said that you can pursue the contribution claim as part of the principal action, is Whiting versus Huffine, 294 NW 2nd, 921. Court stated each joint tortfeasor is responsible for the wrong that they may be sued jointly or severally, subject, however, to the right of contribution among joint tortfeasors, which right may be exercised by the defending party in the principal action.
But that quote taken literally doesn't protect your client against the plaintiff. It protects your client against Pew, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it would apply to the plaintiff as well, Your Honor. Subject to the right of contribution among joint tortfeasors, which right may be exercised by the defending party in the principal action. So I can pursue a claim for contribution in the principal action, but the tortfeasor is responsible for the wrong, subject to that right of contribution.
Pugh's judgment proof and sitting in a federal penitentiary can't pay his share, and the ultimate loss sentence allocated to the plaintiff, not your client, the other defendant?
Under a pure joint and several liability, my client would be responsible for the whole. Under my application of 15.8, 15.1, my client would only be responsible for twice its percentage of fault, if it's less than 50% of fault. Let me compare that, if I could, and this is not a negligence case, so I'm not applying negligence law, but let me compare that to contributory negligence. We have statutes in place that our legislature has issued that limit a plaintiff's right to recover. We don't have a pure comparative negligence system. So I believe there's a precedent of limiting plaintiff's claims and again, not making defendants pay based on their ability to pay, but rather pay based upon the amount of fault that they have in a particular situation.
Mr. Peterson, before you sit down here, you raised three issues. You discussed the contribution. The first issue you raised, however, was that the was a general issue of material fact as to whether or not the interference was unwarranted. You haven't said a word about that. And when you said you had two issues, are you abandoning that issue?
No, I'm not abandoning that issue, Your Honor. And I'm going to have to rely on my brief or also in my time I have for rebuttal, but primarily we are not a converter. We did not take the grain. We were a good faith purchaser of converted products. And I understand good faith is not a defense in the primary action, in the primary conversion act. But rather, when we're a good faith purchaser, I think there's law out there that we've discussed at pages 12 through 14 of our brief that answers that question.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, it's not clear from the record that Westcon owned all of the grain. And Chad Silty testified as much. He said he could not state categorically that Westcon owned all the grain. I think my time is about up for this half. I would like to address the mitigation rule if I could later on.
Well, you can only rebut what they say because they don't get to rebut yours, so you're limited to what they're going to talk about.
Then I'll have to rely on my brief for that, too, Your Honor.
Very well.
Okay. Ms. Dorsett, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. As we've indicated, we are going to be dividing our argument, and I'm going to be addressing the first two issues that have been raised in appellant's issues presented to this court. Specifically, they're seeking reversal on the grounds that we didn't prove our prima facie case of conversion, and secondly, that the damages that the trial court determined were improper and reversals justified on that grounds as well. One thing that needs to remain constant through this argument is that we are dealing with conversion, which is an intentional tort. If a jury were to be presented with a conversion case, they would hear that there are four elements. And for the purposes of today, it appears only two of those elements are disputed. Number one, did Westcon actually own the grain at issue? And number two, did LeBolt seriously interfere with Westcon's interest or possessory interest or ownership in that grain? I would submit to you as to the first issue that the ownership of Westcon was in that grain was very clear. The trial court heard the arguments that were presented and rejected them. The undisputed facts presented to the trial court included that Westcon had grain losses exceeding $700,000. The undisputed fact is that Lynn Pugh admits he was stealing grain from Westcon, and LeBolt's own records demonstrated that they purchased over $424,000 of that grain directly from Lynn Pugh. Lynn Pugh testified, and it's undisputed in this record, that if he was selling grain to LeBolt, he had stolen it from Westcon. Any other argument to the contrary is mere speculation that was not founded or presented with any conclusive material fact, and the trial court rejected it, rightfully. The next point of contention is this argument that Westcon failed to prove unwarranted interference with their interest in this grain. And they have mistakenly equated unwarranted interference with wrongful. That is not the test. That is not the standard. And in fact, if you look at our courts and other state courts' explanations of what the law of conversion is, the words unwarranted interference and unauthorized exercise are used interchangeably. That's because unwarranted means not authorized, not permitted. An act of conversion cannot lie if you voluntarily transfer the property. That's what unwarranted interference is. In this case, we were stolen from. And the argument that we need to prove wrongful is absolutely misplaced. That seeks to add potentially an element to conversion, which is not grounded in the law. And they also seek to substantially change the way this court has defined conversion for years. And what LeBolt seeks to do even further is say, now that I've convinced you that this unwarranted interference means wrongful, then I get to prove why I wasn't wrongful. I get to prove good faith. I get to prove that we had the absence of bad faith. And again, our courts have been extremely clear that bad faith or good faith is not a defense to a conversion claim. This has been repeatedly stated. For example, this court in Finnegg versus Pipestone, I'm quoting, the basis of liability for conversion is the fact that the commission merchant stands in the shoes of the principal. It is immaterial that the agent neither had knowledge nor notice that the principal was committing a wrong by the sale. And this court has said in Lynch versus Riddle's jury, which has been cited repeatedly, Riddle's defense that the conversion was inadvertent or done in good faith was of little consequence in relation to liability. So any argument that advances that their good faith or absence of bad faith is somehow a defense is direct contradiction to our well-settled law. They next seek reversal of this entire matter based on the fact that the amount of damages Westcon may be able to recover is disputed. I would submit to you that the damages couldn't be more certain. LeBolt did not directly challenge LeBolt's claimed losses of over $700,000. Later, the parties agreed that LeBolt had purchased from Westcon or from Linpew over $424,000 of grain. That's the damages amount that we are dealing with. There is absolutely no record evidence that Linpew was stealing grain from anybody else other than a speculative statement made by a farmer that was not followed up on. There was no civil claim arising from that. There were no criminal charges arising from that. And the record is absolutely devoid of any suggestion or proof that if Linpew was stealing from this farmer also, that he sold the grain at LeBolt. That critical tie is missing. And that's why the trial court rejected that argument. So the damages in this case are also extremely certain. The next issue I want to address is this claim that Westcon is not entitled to their judgment because they failed to mitigate their losses. I submit to you that that is also a direct misstatement or misapplication of the law of conversion. This essentially comes down to an assertion that Westcon had a duty to prevent an ongoing intentional tort before they knew Linpew was the tortfeasor. That is not the law. That is not how it applies. Westcon was taking efforts to prevent or figure out what was going on. They were searching their records. They were searching the records of another elevator. They were speaking with law enforcement. There was a point where they had law enforcement driving by. But even if you want to accept the facts in a light most favorable to the appellant, then we agree on the most critical fact here, the only one that's material, the fact that Linpew was discovered one night loading up his truck and he was arrested. That's when the damages stopped. Our duty to mitigate started at that point because that's when we knew, when we had specific information about what was going on with Linpew. By design, the criminal law operates the same way. This would not be a defense in a criminal case, nor would it be a defense, for example, if an employer had been embezzled from by his employee for years. The fact that the employee can point to bookkeeping problems, or that maybe their checks and balances system wasn't as good as it could have been, or the fact that they didn't notify law enforcement quick enough is not a defense in the criminal system, and by design, it's the same on the civil side. It guides us to the right result. The Security Bank versus Benning case that they have cited is wholly distinguishable because in that case, again, we had a secured creditor who found out his debtor was converting secured collateral. You know what they did after they found out he was doing it? Loaned him more money. And they also paid off junior creditors, which then increased the amount of money that they were lost. That's where that mitigation issue came into effect. That is not present in this case. I'd also point you to the universal premium case, which is also consistent with the restatement of torts. They said that the duty to mitigate your losses arises when you have specific information to work with. The point at which they knew Lynn Pugh was stealing from them, it stopped. There was no other losses, and we're not claiming any other losses after that point. Finally, I just want to point out that the damages in this case are they're appropriate. The trial court considered all of the arguments that have been raised here today. And you're going to hear arguments about constructive trust and the fact that WestCon has this affirmative duty or obligation to seek property from Lynn Pugh and then give LeBolt credit. Well, that's precisely what we did. The judgment that was obtained in this case does reflect credit to LeBolt for things that we recovered from Lynn Pugh. Not to mention, you don't get a jury trial on that issue anyway. Judgments are reduced, set off, partially satisfied all the time. Every time that issue presents itself, a creditor or a debtor doesn't get a jury trial on that issue. It just happens.
Does it also reflect the amount of grain that LeVault gave back to your client?
Yes. My understanding is that it does.
So they've already gotten credit for that. That isn't something they're supposed to get credit or set off for later.
Correct. Yes. And I just want to point out also that in the secured transactions setting, for example, if LeBolt had purchased grain from Lynn Pugh and he had mortgages on that grain, this would be the same result.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Mr. Russman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to apologize, I think, in advance for what I think might turn out to be a little bit of an incoherent argument, because I think that the Uniform Contribution Among Joint Tortfeasors Act is somewhat incoherent. But this is what I understand it does, and how it plays into this case. LeBolt seeks reversal based on a theory that they're entitled to submit to the jury the entirety of this case based upon their interpretation of the Contribution Act. I don't think that's the way it works. If we look at some of the cases that have interpreted the Contribution Act in other contexts, the way it works is if there is a jury trial where the apportionment issue comes up, the jury is instructed to determine the issues of liability and damages first, and if they determine that there is liability and they have determined damages, they at that point are instructed specially to apply this apportionment analysis as though it were a completely separate matter. I think I've even seen language in an instruction as though it were a completely separate trial. That happens because those cases were required to go to trial because there were material issues as far as liability and damages in dispute. Therefore, a jury trial was appropriate. Here, there are no material issues of damages or liability in dispute because it's a conversion case. And I think that the trial court correctly determined that. All that we had to prove was that it was our grain. We did not authorize its transfer or sale to or purchase by LeBolt, and they exercised possession of it. And we had to prove the damages, which we were able to do. None of that was in dispute. So we are not left with a traditional jury trial or finder of fact trial on issues of liability or damages. That's been determined.
Mr. Restman, isn't under the Uniform Act limitation, if it's less than 50% fault, to twice the percentage of fault? How does that play into this case? Are you saying that doesn't apply at all because there was summary judgment?
I'm saying it does not apply at all at this point, because what they're asking this court to do is reverse Judge Timm's summary judgment on the issue of liability and damages based upon an interpretation of the Contribution Act. And one of the justices mentioned that this is that asked the question of Mr. Peterson, is this not premature? I think the answer to that is yes.
What? At what point? How does he get to that point then?
I think he initiates an action against Lynn Pugh for contribution. The action, the fact is, I don't think we really have a dog in that fight. The theory of contribution, as I understand it, is a theory that involves the joint tortfeasors only and their responsibilities vis-a-vis one another. It does not involve the plaintiff it should not be involving the plaintiff or an adjustment to the overall judgment. So I don't think, if we're looking specifically at what Judge Tim has done, he has issued a summary judgment and a judgment in favor of Westcon in determining that there was liability for conversion and determining that there were damages. That's all he has done.
Just so I understand, you're saying that that act then does not limit damages to 20% or to double the percentage of fault. As to your client?
As to my client, no. Because it's inconsistent with the theory of joint and several liability. And it's also inconsistent with the theory of contribution. Mr. Peterson brought this up, and this wasn't something that I had planned on mentioning. He talked about the sort of historical context of the Contribution Act and what happened in 1987. Well, I don't think we really know, but I think that these sections 15.1 and 15.2 were probably in response to some kind. It was probably a response to something that happened to set up a hybrid of a comparative negligence system. That's what I think happened. But that's negligence. That has no applicability to the law of the law when we're dealing with an intentional tort. That's what LeBolt has been trying to do all along. It has been trying to contort some, whether it's mitigation, whether it's contribution, whatever. They're trying to contort this into a situation where they can get in front of a jury and ask the jury to compare liability. And that's not supposed to happen in an intentional tort case. That's what they're trying to do. Because what they'd like to do is they'd like to convince this court, hey, we had a right to get a jury trial on this contribution issue. And then go to the jury trial and explain to the jury, this just isn't fair. We were an innocent purchaser for value. That's what they would like to do. And I don't think that that's consistent with the state of the law on either the what you have to prove in order to prove conversion, contribution, or the concept of joint and several. This issue has been discussed as well. Another reason why I think that we're at a point that would be considered premature in terms of contribution or operating under the Act is because the Act itself says that the joint tortfeasor is not entitled to contribution from the other joint tortfeasor unless and until he is extinguished the entirety of the judgment against him. That hasn't happened. That's never happened. It didn't happen before the judgment, and it hasn't happened now. I don't think that he's even in a position to seek contribution. But if he is in a position to seek contribution, that's in a separate action, and I think that that involves the joint tortfeasors as opposed to the plaintiff. I do not think that the Act is designed to limit the amount that a wronged plaintiff can receive under a valid judgment. Unless the court has any further questions, I believe I've concluded my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Russman.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Peterson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you to my colleague for raising the issue of mitigation of damages, because I would like to talk to you just briefly about that. I think the facts are compelling. String out a little timeline here. January of 2003, LeBolt buys 4 loads of grain. Northern Lights Energy buys 8 to 10 loads of grain. fast forward to May of, I said 1993, but I meant 2003. Fast forward to May of 2003, there's a break-in and a burglary of a vending machine or something like that in the office of the of Westcon's facility. Incidental to reporting that burglary, Mick Johnson, the manager of the elevator, reports, by the way, we're missing 22,000 bushel of soybeans valued at $130,000. I assume that my client's four loads that were purchased in that time period would be part of that 22,000, but it doesn't account for the extra 8 or 10 loads of grain to Northern Lights. So we have a pretty massive loss. And during this period of time, Chad Silty, the credit manager, testified that initially when we took over the elevator from Harvest States, we thought there was just some abnormal shrinkage because we were short on grain when we did our measurements. When we found out there was an abnormal shrinkage or when it recurred, we knew there was another problem. So we went back to Harvest States and we said, did you properly measure the grain that you sold us when we took over the facility? The answer to that was yes. The next issue was maybe the bin capacity has been improperly measured or assessed. Maybe they aren't as big as we thought they were. Maybe that accounts for our loss. The answer to that was no, they're measured properly. A Harvest States employee had been carried over into employment with Westcon. That employee left rather unexpectedly, and because she left, they started wondering if maybe she had been involved in somehow manipulating the books, that would account for the shortage. And they also did internal investigation of other employees. To quote Chad Silty, people were pretty much on edge at that facility. They had gone through that analysis and tried to rule out every other cause they could think of. So when we get to May of 2003, Mick Johnson correctly assesses, I think there's criminal activity. In fact, he says, I think they're stockpiling the grain someplace, or I think they're acting in complicity with some other elevator to offload the grain and get it marketed someplace else. Clear to them by May of 2003, there was criminal activity going on. If you look at that universal premium case that was cited by the appellees, by Westcon, there was a series of checks that were written over the course of several months in a scheme by a scammer. And at the end of that case, the Universal Premium Court notes that we did not have a series of individual torts. We had an injury in the form of the scheme, and the damages were each check that was written afterwards. I submit that that's the analysis this court should apply. The injury was known in May of 2003 when criminal activity was the only remaining unanswered question. And after that May of 2003, there were some 80 additional loads of grain that were taken from Westcon's facility. Now, do they have an obligation to prevent theft at the beginning? No, but once they become aware that it's there, they do have a duty to mitigate their damages. And that duty is to exercise reasonable diligence and to do the best they can to lessen their damages and prevent future loss. That comes right out of the jury instructions and out of cases from this court. FINAG what only nominally tells us a little bit about applying mitigation of damages in conversion cases, and it's simply because the trial court had to be reversed on other issues. The trial court was ordered to consider the issue of damages, which had not been previously considered, including mitigation of damages. In the Security State Bank of Benning, whether it was issues of mitigation of damages for loaning more money or allowing more goods to be sold isn't the question. The question is, did the plaintiff in this case fail its duty to mitigate its damages by whatever happened? I mean, in our construct, it happens to be the criminal conduct, the ongoing criminal conduct of Lynn Pugh. Addressing some of Mr. Russman's comments in reference to the Uniform Act, if we apply the interpretation that Westcon wants to put on Section 15.1, Section 15.1 would have to be read this way, because this court has an obligation to look at the plain meaning of the act and not insert words or take words out or apply other judicial construction to achieve a result. Westcon wants you to read it this way. If the court enters judgment against any party, and I note that there's no distinction about any party, liable on the basis of joint and several liability, and it doesn't say liable to other defendants, it has no restrictive language about who we're talking about, any party who has allocated less than 50% of the total fault allocated to all parties, again, no restrictions on whether we're talking about plaintiffs or defendants, may not be jointly liable, and here's the words that Westcon wants to read into the statute, may not be jointly liable to the other defendants for not more than twice its percentage of fault. I submit that that's an interpretation of that statute that cannot be supported by the clear meaning of the statute.
What about the argument, though, that it doesn't apply to intentional torts? These two, 15.1 and 15.2, apply only to negligence.
There's no such restriction there, Your Honor. It talks about the fault of a party, and it doesn't talk about intentional fault or unintentional fault. It simply assesses the phrase may not be jointly liable for more than twice the percentage of fault allocated to that party. If I could go back to Justice Zinter's question in the first half of my or in the first portion of my oral argument, the court would not have to rule on the cross claims during the principal action, but Section 15 of the statute of the Uniform Act says that where there is such a disproportion of fault among joint tortfeasors as to render inequitable an equal distribution among them of the common liability, then the relative degrees of fault shall be considered. I think it was error for the trial court not to adjust the relative degrees of fault so that they could be considered. We then, again, as I said earlier, would step in and pay our percentage of fault or our twice the percentage if we're less than 50%, and then we go back to court. Mr. Russman says he may not have a dog in this fight. I agree. We'll go back to court and get our judgment for contribution. But to get there and to give 15-8-15.1 any meaning at all, we have to adjust the percentages of fault in the primary action.
You keep using the word fault. Is that even applicable to conversion? It sounds more like a negligence term to me.
Well, I would beg the court to consider those cases in the discussion that we have at pages 12 through 14 of our opening brief, because again, I think there's a distinction between one who intentionally converts another's property. And I understand it's not intentional, it's not good faith, bad faith, and all those other issues that we've pretty well cemented in our law. But when we move to the next level where we have a good faith purchaser of converted goods, I think there's a different analysis that needs to be applied. So my answer, Your Honor, is yes, we do need to consider fault. We do need to consider it and not just rule categorically that this was an intentional act done by LeBolt.
But the conversion statute hasn't changed since 1877.
I understand that, although there's been a lot of law that has been discussing it, and laws in other jurisdictions give us some guidance on good faith purchasers for value. We do that in the context of secure transactions. We talk in the Food Security Act that was discussed at length in the FinAg cases talks about the protection that's given good faith purchasers. Frankly, if there had been an electronic financing statement filed in this action, then LeBolt wouldn't have anything to talk to you about because they would have been on notice that this grain didn't belong to Lynn Pugh, or at least that it wasn't unencumbered. We believe that in applying the standard of review in a summary judgment case where doubts are resolved in favor of the non-moving party and where we're given the best construction of the evidence, that mitigation of damages should have been considered as an element of damages, as Ms. Dorsett presented to the court. And because there's a strong argument that our client is less than 50% liable, there's a strong argument that its liability should have been apportioned so that not more than twice its percentage of fault can be assessed, and ask the court to reverse the trial court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. The court will be in recess.